Today, I'm really pleased to welcome Sarah Margot. Sarah was the recipient of our first Helen Marston Compassionate Advocacy Award, working on a legal reform project. Can I ask you to introduce yourself, Sarah?
Sure. Hello. So thank you, Rachel, and thank you to HRA for the chance to chat today. So my name is Sarah Margot, and my background is in animal law. And that's all about working towards animal protection through legal means. It kind of takes shape in various ways. So working with the laws we've got, there's community education, there's providing legal advice, representation, or, you know, supporting animal charities and organisations. But I'd say the most work comes from trying to change the law. So many animal lawyers work in advocacy and campaigns, and ultimately seeking law and policy reform. And this is really important because, unfortunately, our existing animal law framework offers very little protection for animals. And in fact, it really just facilitates their use.
Yes, yep. And I'm assuming we'll go into this. This applies to animals in research as well.
It does.
Yeah. Well, for the benefit of our listeners, Sarah's been working on a project which has been formulating a strategy for HRA to identify priorities for legal reform and how we may seek to obtain that legal reform, and a toolkit that we can use to implement that. May I ask, Sarah, what was your motivation for applying for the Helen Marston Compassionate Advocacy Award?
Sure. Well, firstly, Helen Marston was a remarkable advocate for animals, so it's an honour to undertake any work and tribute to her, and especially work to take on a deeply problematic industry. I mean, I've long admired the work of HRA and other organisations in this space because, quite simply, it's overwhelming to realise the depth of suffering in animal experimentation. And there's a clear and urgent need for law and policy reform in this space. And I think a lot of people are surprised to learn that animal testing is still a major part of research in Australia. And then they're shocked to learn that certain experiments that seem archaic still go on as a matter of routine practice. But part of the reason I was so keen to work in this space is because we live in this amazing time of technology where we have non-animal methods that are advancing far beyond what we can achieve with animal testing. And these alternative technologies are producing better outcomes for human health, and they're doing so more efficiently and without the cruelty. So the science is on side, the public is on side, it's better for human health, it's better for the economy. This is one of those very few areas where everything is aligned and there's a realistic solution. It's ready to go and it benefits all parties. So I guess this space feels hopeful. Mm. It feels like there's a real chance to get serious reforms through and just get us one step closer to transitioning away from using animals for research.
Thank you. And that really leads on to my next question, actually, which is, I'm interested to know a bit more about the priority areas that you've identified for reform for HRA to work on, and how and why these areas were selected out of the many areas that we could be working on.
So even though, like we just said, we talked about, the time is ripe and it does make perfect sense, it's still a challenge to get Australian governments to embrace reform. I don't know exactly why that is. There's this bizarre reluctance on behalf of lawmakers to change the way things are done. Perhaps we're too conservative, perhaps we have too much faith in tradition, or, you know, something about fear of losing votes, or maybe it just comes down to stubbornness and not wanting to concede that respect for animals is legitimate, because that also means conceding that the way we've treated them to date is not. In identifying priority areas for reform, it was really a matter of assessing each issue for its, I guess you could say, its balance of impact and feasibility. So nothing overly ambitious, like end all research now or animal research now, even though that would be fantastic. Yeah. but going for still impactful but realistic goals. So some things that seemed incontrovertible. So, for example, banning certain very cruel tests like smoking tests and swim tests, which have, you know, those have been scientifically shown to be ineffective, and they've already been shunned in many jurisdictions overseas and are not used by a growing list of big pharma companies. And then there are, there were quite a number of other priority areas, but I'll just give a couple more examples. One we focused on was transparency. And quite simply, we don't know how many animals are used and for what. And this is crucial for industry oversight. And it's part of dismantling this blind belief that animal testing is rarely used, and when it is, that it's adequately regulated. Mm. And then, of course, solutions-focused advocacy is also very important. So a priority area identified was funding and legislative support for alternatives. That's alternatives to animal testing. And that's important so that we can give the industry a clear pathway out of this and so that they can transition away.
Well, thank you very much. And from delving deeper into the regulatory framework around animal experimentation, what would you describe as its greatest limitation in protecting animals from harm?
So I think there are a lot of problems with the regulatory framework, but one of the biggest limitations is its dependence on self-regulation.
Yes, yeah.
So when it comes to animal testing, each university or research facility itself, they set up an internal animal ethics committee, which is then responsible for determining what animal research can occur and what is considered, in quotation marks, ethical. So when really a lot of what happens to animals in research would actually constitute animal cruelty under our laws, were it not for the operation of exemptions and defences for that research. Mm-hmm. So you've got sentient animals that are being subjected to what would otherwise be a criminal offence, but as long as the research facility has a licence to operate and the go-ahead from an internal ethics committee, then the research is considered lawful. And I'd say this kind of work desperately needs external oversight and enforcement. And it's especially problematic given that some institutions self-regulate but also derive income or profit from the use of animals. So there's a very serious conflict of interest, for example, if an institution is associated with an animal breeding facility. And those kinds of conflicts arise all of the time, especially in animal ethics committees and that system of approval for research.
Yes, it becomes self-regulation,
Exactly. It becomes more administrative rather than held to a standard that could enliven criminal law.
Yes, that's interesting, actually, because we did an interview previously with a member of an animal ethics committee, and they mentioned some similar points about the self-regulation and the limitations of the animal ethics committees in making decisions.
And I think it's very important work for people who are on animal ethics committees, but they just come up against a lot of obstacles in trying to get their perspective across or trying to prevent research, essentially.
Yeah, so you're suggesting really the framework needs a independent body beyond that to better regulate that system so it's more independent.
Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you. And as I mentioned, you've been putting together a toolkit to present to HRA that we can use for this area of our work, which is very important for us. And one of the key resources you have developed, it's focused on the need for a review of the Australian Code for the Care and Use of Animals for Scientific Purposes. And we intend to be using this widely as a priority campaign. So in your opinion, why is this review needed?
Well, the Australian Code is the national set of guidelines for animal research. It's not enforceable by itself, but it does dictate the minimum standards for animal research. And then the states and territories come along and they implement and enforce the code to various degrees. It's kind of at their discretion. So the code does have teeth in those jurisdictions where compliance with the code is mandatory. And that's places like Western Australia, Queensland, and Tasmania. And it also has teeth in regards to any research that's funded by the NHMRC. Mm-hmm. So all NHMRC funded research has to comply with the code. And there's a lot of that, it's not insignificant. So any change to the code or update there would impact a lot of research across Australia. But the biggest issue with the code is that it sets our minimum standards, but it's completely out of date. I mean, it hasn't been reviewed for 10 years, which is a long time when you consider how rapidly our scientific knowledge has advanced in the last decade. We're not looking at the same industry that we had 10 years ago. And other countries have far surpassed Australia already. And in many regards, we're lagging behind not just international jurisdictions, but even our local states and territories, and behind community sentiment. So, for example, a lot of people in Australia would support giving animals a kinder life after research, yet the code still doesn't require rehoming or retirement. And we really need to look to some kind of national guideline to make sure that this inconsistent raft of legislation across Australia is lifted harmoniously, and that animals across the country enjoy a better quality of life.
Thank you. And HRA, we often hear that the defence that there is a robust regulatory framework for protecting animals used in science in Australia, which prevents unnecessary suffering. And we do receive this standard response several times a year. How would you respond to this claim, having conducted this project for HRA?
I think we generally place a lot of faith in our legal systems. And this might be because we expect, rightfully so, that any use of animals that knowingly causes harm would be tightly regulated. But unfortunately, that's just not the case when it comes to a lot of animal use industries. And it's no different for the regulation of animal testing. I think, like I said in the beginning of this chat, a lot of our animal law exists to facilitate animal use rather than protect animals. And there's a lot we could talk about here, but to really just focus on that false sense of security, I'll spend a few minutes on the three R's.
Mm-hmm.
So the three R's are, for our listeners, they're replacement, reduction, and refinement. And that refers to replacing the use of animals in research, reducing the number of animals used in research, and refining experimental design to cause less suffering or to mitigate harm. And yes, the three R's are a core principle in the regulatory framework, and we tend to take peace of mind from that because we think, great, a founding principle is to better protect and stop using animals. But in reality, the ability of the three R's to protect animal welfare is significantly limited, and it's quite deeply flawed. I mean, to begin with, the principles of reduction and refinement are still problematic for animals. The decisions to reduce the number of animals in experimental design, it doesn't stop the use of animals. And it's also left to the discretion of researchers, who can only base their justification on pre-existing scientific method. And further, a reduction in the overall number of animals might just result in extended or repeated experimentation on fewer individuals. And then refinement is similarly subjective. And in effect, it's just about finding ways to mitigate harm rather than to prevent harm. Replacement, on the other hand, is certainly impactful. And I think this is what our legislation really needs to focus on. The issue, however, is that replacement as a concept is neither legally required nor funded. So it's rarely implemented. So in terms of legal requirements, researchers and ethic committees just have to show that they've considered replacement options. And that's it, a consideration. That's a very soft approach. And in terms of funding, I mean, the problem is ingrained in Australia because there's been a historical lack of funding and support for other valid scientific methods, I mean, other than animal testing. So there's no dedicated industry for non-animal alternatives to combat this deep-seated dependence on using animals. There's desire from researchers, and there's precedent from overseas, and we can see what amazing things are being achieved elsewhere. But here in Australia, there's little support. And, you know, that's despite the fact that several other countries around the world have already established national centres for the development of alternatives. And taking the UK, for example, they've gone a step further and they've actually legally required the development of alternatives. So it's in the legislation. It's more than just a government policy. And I think we need to see something similar and legally binding in Australia too.
Thank you, Sarah. Yes, I think the fact that the point that you mentioned, we often hear research institutions will say legally they will only be able to use animals where there's no alternative available, but really that's not legally mandated. It's just, as you said, they have to consider.
It's discretionary, that's right.
Yeah, rather than any mandatory thing that they're going to be penalised for if they don't adhere to. Following on from this, I think that's one of the myths, but you have identified several myths about animal research legislation, referring to that and the three R's providing a robust framework. Can you share any other myths or the accompanying myth buster?
I think the thing I found quite interesting while doing this research and doing this work for HRA is I hear from a lot of people, people I chat to who are kind of either involved or not involved with the industry, I hear a lot, but isn't it required? So isn't animal testing required for drug development or product development in Australia? And the answer, as far as my research shows, is no. There's no legal requirement in Australia to test new products on animals. That's the case in some overseas jurisdictions, but not here. We're already in a position where we can welcome alternative methods. And the use of animals in research has been a long-standing scientific method in Australia, that's for sure. And as a result, the use of animals has become, I guess, an assumed component of research. So sadly, what we hear from leading institutions is that current best practice is to use animals. And that's reflected in the practices of some journals, which expect animal test data. And, you know, in guidelines for things like the Therapeutic Goods Act, which frequently infer that valid test data should come from animal research. But the fact is, it's not a legal requirement to test on animals in Australia. And we just shouldn't be on relying how things have always been done. We need to change that.
Thank you. I think that's a very important myth to bust there. So if you could change one thing for animals in laboratories, what would that be?
I had to get them out of there. Yeah. I mean, first and foremost, I'd want a full transition to non-animal alternatives. Short of that, I mean, gosh, really all of it. I mean, mandatory pain relief, mandatory rehoming, non-invasive procedures. But to be frank, I really just, I can't imagine anything that would make it okay to keep animals in laboratories. I think the time has come to embrace the non-animal methodology in its entirety.
Yeah, thank you. And what action can our listeners take to improve legal protection specifically for animals used in research and teaching?
Well, people power can be very effective for legal change, and a lot of lawmakers will only engage with an issue if the public has demanded it. And, you know, we often hear about this tipping point, a point where you can't return from because enough people want change. And so, for example, some of the successful HRA campaigns have depended on public petitions to change practices, like getting university students to petition for an end to forced swim testing. So I would encourage all listeners to make their voice heard, write to your local politicians, speak to your workplaces or schools or universities. I mean, animal research is more prevalent than we realise. There's animal research, research in all levels of schooling, universities, wherever you work. And if you inform yourself and speak up, eventually the number of people speaking out builds to a point where we can't be ignored anymore.
Yeah, thank you. So that was a really enlightening in podcast, Sarah, and I just wanted to thank you for all the time you've put into this project. I think it's put HRA into such a strong position to be able to advocate for legal reform, and that's a fundamental part of our work because so much is reliant on legal frameworks and refuting those claims that are made and trying to change the systems, which is a long-term effort, but we really value all the work that you've done. And I'd also like to acknowledge Animals Australia, who we partnered with on this project. So for our listeners, Helen Marston was HRA's former CEO, and she worked for HRA and Animals Australia, and in both cases, advocating for animals used in research. And that was her great passion in life. So I'm sure she would be amazed by the work that you've been doing, Sarah. So I really just wanted to thank you and wish you all the well in the rest of your career advocating for animals and legal reform, because we know that there's so many changes that need to be made across all areas of animal protection. So thank you.
It's been such an interesting and important part of my work. Thank you for the opportunity, and I will continue to follow and admire the work of HRA and Animals Australia and keep fighting. I mean, we all need to. So let's bring an end to animal testing.
Thank you so much, Sarah. It's a pleasure having you on. Bye.
Thanks very much. Bye.